Network Europe, a program from Radio E, a partnership of Europe's international broadcasters.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Network Europe. I'm Barbara Grobon. Coming up on the program, Europe Day was celebrated around the continent this week. But is Europe really in a festive mood? And where's the continent heading after last year's major setback to the European Constitution? We'll learn why more and more Poles are looking for jobs in neighbouring Hungary, Slovakia and the Czech Republic. And can a contemporary art show improve the image of French Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin? All those stories and more coming up on the programme. It's been almost a year since French and Dutch voters rejected the European Constitution and plunged the EU into its worst ever crisis. What followed was a so-called period of reflection on the future of Europe. That's at least what EU leaders had called for. Time to address questions on the future of the European Constitution, the boundaries of Europe and the aims and goals of European integration. 1 year later, however, there are still no answers, and Europeans seem to be more disgruntled than ever. But this week, Europe Day offered an opportunity for the EU to reach out to its citizens. The day is held to mark the creation of a united Europe. In Berlin, German Chancellor Angela Merkel used the occasion to address the question of the failed EU constitution. She said it should be revived, but conceded that the timing of such a move was crucial. But Merkel said first and foremost the European Union should live up to its economic potential and convince people it's working for their economic and social security. Guy Deegan has more.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel is already chomping at the bit in anticipation of Germany's turn as European Union president next year. Europe, says Merkel, is not achieving its potential.
Erstens, Europa ist besser als sein Ruf.
Firstly, Europe is better than its reputation. Secondly, Europe isn't good enough. And thirdly, Europe must and also can be better.
Chancellor Merkel wants more internationally competitive European companies. She argues that Europe will only be able to use the opportunities offered by the EU's internal market if there are European champions in areas such as energy and postal services.
Das heißt, aus meiner tiefen Überzeugung heraus ist es deshalb auch unbedingt notwendig.
I'm convinced that it's absolutely essential to push forward the integration processes in Europe, otherwise there'll be a regression with unwanted consequences.
Looking ahead, such unwanted consequences, as the Chancellor puts it, could also result from the difficulties of passing the EU constitution. In contrast to Germany, France and the Netherlands both rejected the constitution last year. Many European analysts believe an enlarged EU needs a constitution in order to function efficiently. As for further enlargement, Chancellor Merkel emphasised that now is the time to clearly define Europe's boundaries and put EU citizens first. The Chancellor asserts that Europe should try to keep its promises, but at the same time should be able to say to certain countries that joining is not possible in the foreseeable future. Even Merkel's political opponent, Gregor Gysi, chairman of Germany's Left Party, points out that many EU citizens are opposed to further expansion of the EU.
Now we are seeing a neoliberal development, which is bringing about competition within the EU. The countries with the lowest taxes, the lowest wages, and the lowest ecological and social standards will have the biggest advantage. That makes people afraid, and rightly so.
And while several countries are still in the EU's waiting room, next week Bulgaria and Romania will find out whether the European Commission will recommend their EU membership to begin as planned in 2007. However, concerns over the slow pace of important reforms, particularly in Bulgaria, is fueling speculation in Brussels that the two Balkan countries may either have to accept entry with further conditions or be forced to wait another 12 months. Chancellor Merkel maintains that whether in 2007 or 2008, Bulgaria and Romania will become EU members, but she added that membership talks are a two-way street and potential new members must meet all EU requirements. Guy Deegan, Deutsche Welle Radio.
Well, as we just heard, Romania and Bulgaria are eagerly awaiting the European Commission report to be published next week on whether they'll be ready to join the European Union in January 2007 or have to wait until 2008. The European Commission might well decide to put their membership on hold and ask for more reforms, especially when it comes to fighting crime and corruption. Bulgaria's Prime Minister Sergei Stanishev warned the EU not to humiliate his country next week and delay EU membership. The uncertainty over EU membership, though, didn't stop Romanians from celebrating Europe Day this week. Julian Morsan from Radio Romania International reports from Bucharest.
Romanians are quick to join the EU in celebration. It's Europe Day, and one can feel that too well in Bucharest's biggest park, where I've just witnessed the inauguration of a monumental compound dedicated to the founding fathers of the European Union. People like Robert Schuman, Jean Monnet, or Johan Willem Bayen, a Dutch foreign minister whose grandson was there for the inauguration.
I'm the grandson of Mr. Willem Bayen, and he was a minister of foreign affairs in the 50s, and he was one of the founding fathers. He had the idea to create a European economic union first.
Despite the Romanian authorities' visible efforts and acknowledged progress, even with 1 week to the much-awaited monitoring report, European officials are evasive as to whether there will be a recommendation for an exact date for accession or not. Brian Forey has been working with the European Commission delegation in Bucharest for 2 years.
Tremendous progress has been made both towards EU accession and towards adopting modern European values. And I think Romania is well on the way for that, and I congratulate them.
So you think that the accession will actually take place in 2007?
I cannot say one way or the other, but signs are looking good from what Commissioner Olli Rehn and others have been saying as well. I think Romania has an openness and a willingness to change, but sometimes it takes a long time to actually put these changes into practice.
Do you think 16 years is enough?
I'm not sure. I mean, look at the time that Ireland and Portugal and Spain took, and Greece. At least 10 years, 15 years, I think, for them, you know. Things are going well for them, so there are good signs there, of good examples for Romania to look to.
Romanian Minister of European Integration, Anca Boagiu, says we shouldn't even expect an exact date for accession to be mentioned by this report.
In any case, the report on the 16th of May will show the stage of the preparation on a very clear and transparent manner as we are used to receive it.
Is there the possibility that the report might not mention or recommend an exact date for accession?
Actually, if we look to the treaty, from a very legal and technical point of view, it shouldn't. Because on the treaty, the accession date for Romania and Bulgaria is the 1st of January 2007. The postponement might happen if the two countries are not ready to become member states. So if we speak from legal and technical point of view, normally we shouldn't have a date in the report. We never had a date in May. We have the technical approach of the preparation process, and the date will be established during the European Council in June, when the final decision will be taken concerning the accession date of the two countries.
Romanians have always been European. This is already a cliche among Romanian and foreign politicians, opinion leaders or intellectuals. But ordinary people seem to be more reserved in claiming their European identity. They want to see to believe.
I would feel a European citizen if I had the opportunity to travel a bit and find out more about the daily life of my fellow European citizens, not just what we see on the TV or in magazines.
Julian Morsan from Radio Romania International reporting on Europe Day in Bucharest. And on to another way of celebrating Europe Day. Cafes are always associated with communication and local culture. They're also a very typical symbol of our common European heritage. That's why the Institute of the Regions of Europe, backed by the Austrian EU presidency, launched a project called Café d'Europe. In 27 cafes in 27 European capitals, coffeehouse discussions took place with writers and the public. It's an occasion to ask questions, brainstorm, and come up with creative and visionary proposals. Radio Prague's Ian Willoughby went to Café Slavia, right in the center of the Czech capital.
The Kavarna Slavia, opposite the National Theatre and with a wonderful view of Prague Castle, is perhaps the best-known café in the Czech Republic. That's no doubt the reason it was chosen as the venue for the Czech part of the Café d'Europe project, which marked Europe Day this year.
Úkolem Evropy už není a nikdy nebude ani vládnout světu, ani v něm násilím šířit svou představu blahobytu a dobra.
Playwright and former Czech president Václav Havel outlines his vision of Europe at Café Slavia. He was one of 27 authors who appeared in coffee houses in the capitals of the EU states and Romania and Bulgaria. The gathering was also attended by students, members of the public and senior politicians, including Czech Prime Minister Jiří Paroubek and the country's European Commissioner Vladimír Špidla. Václav Havel clearly enjoyed the meeting.
Byla to tedy akce pen klubu spisovatelů intelektuálů.
It was organized by the Writers and Intellectuals Association, the Pen Club, although there are also a lot of different politicians here today. It was a good opportunity to put questions to them. For instance, it's not often we get a chance to meet our European Commissioner. This event was interesting and important.
Austria, which currently holds the EU presidency, was the main organizer of the Café d'Europe project. Its ambassador to Prague is Margot Klestil, whose late husband Tomás Klestil was Austria's president. I asked her, why cafes?
I think that we should not limit the discussion about Europe to Brussels, to Strasbourg, to the headquarters of the, let's say, of the European Union. We have to go out and try to meet as many people as possible with our ideas. And I think coffee houses are very popular meeting points. And I think in this respect, it's a good initiative of the Austrian presidency.
Why have you chosen to invite writers to speak?
You know, coffee houses like the Café Slavia here, they are also the meeting points of intellectuals. And we need intellectuals like Václav Havel to spread out new ideas, to give people visions and to make people confident about the European project. And I think that Jiří Gruža, he's head of the PEN Club, he made the right decision to invite writers to this event.
Finally, what does it mean to you that Václav Havel was the speaker here today?
It meant a lot of me, to me personally, because Václav Havel was a good friend of my husband. They were close friends. And it was really great to see him again. And he is, as I said already, one of the greatest political visionaries, and to have him here at this event launched by the Austrian presidency, it's a great honor for me personally and for my country.
Radio Prague's Ian Willoughby reporting there from Café Slavia in Prague, and let's hope that this project will not be a one-off event. There's undoubtedly a big communication deficit between Brussels and EU citizens. And even though there have been many initiatives to change this, the European Union remains for many something distant and quite abstract. It's important to regain citizens' trust, Commission President José Manuel Barroso said this week. The way to strengthen public confidence in Europe, he added, is through results. EU leaders and institutions have lost touch with the concerns of its citizens, agrees Kordula Janowski from the Center for European Integration Studies in Bonn.
When you look at the Eurobarometer and ask people, where do you believe in, whom do you trust from the EU institutions, you will see that the European Court of Justice and the European Parliament make the race. So those institutions that are in contact with the people in Europe, the EU Commission so-so, but the Council of Ministers definitely not. So, and this is a question where the EU has to ask itself, how do we come closer to the people? We have the constitution, and one thing I was really missing in the debate is that no one mentioned that the part two of the constitution includes the European Charter of Fundamental Rights. I mean, what is more attracting to citizens, if I ask myself, I'm also an EU citizen, than seeing and reading your individual rights in Europe? So we are all talking about questions of the EC policy, budget, agricultural reform. Sometimes we also talk about complex mechanism of decision-making in the institutions. But no one has so far really started to explain citizens their rights and telling them that they are written down in this constitution.
you're touching upon the European Constitution. This week, Estonia became the 15th country to ratify the Charter. The Finnish Parliament is scheduled to ratify the Constitution in a few weeks' time. EU institutions have put it back on the agenda without really coming up with anything concrete there. How do you personally see the future of the European Constitution? Is it dead?
Well, sometimes also researchers would love to have a magic ball. These days, I would really like to have a short glance inside. Actually, at the moment, it is very, very open. But what is definitely for sure is three things. So first of all, the question and the whole arguments about the Constitution has a deeper layer, and this is the finality question. Still today, we do not know exactly where the EU is heading. Yeah, we don't know the final objective. This makes it difficult if we use in this context a term like constitution. Constitution states stands for something like a state. Yeah, states, constitution, states, people, state, government. So for some people, this is a horror trip. And this leads to the second thing. I think it is not very probable that we can keep this term because the EU constitution is not a constitution founding a state. It is a treaty. It is a treaty like the Maastricht Treaty, the Treaty of Nice, Amsterdam. Maybe this will be then the Treaty of Rome, Brussels, or wherever. Also, we have to see that we can simply not go over this constitution and say, okay, it was a nice try, now come up with the next idea. We don't want this at the moment. Also, because you mentioned 15 countries. 15 countries is 60% of all the EU members. They also represent 70% of the EU's population. So we are also talking these days about democracy. So please, I ask those people who are critical, explain me how you want to go over 70% of the EU citizens. And also these member states have to ask themselves, the governments, you were present in the convention. You signed this thing. Why did you sign this if you don't like it?
Kordula Janowski there, Program Director at the Center for European Integration Studies in Bonn. You're listening to Network Europe. Time now on the program for the weekly briefing from Brussels with our correspondent Stephen Castle.
The sun was shining in Brussels this week, and even more surprising, the European Commission was talking about sun lotion. Gunther Verheugen, the European Industry Commissioner, thinks that makers of sunscreens are putting people at risk of skin cancer by using vague or misleading labels such as sunblocker or total protection. Mr. Verheugen wants manufacturers to agree new guidelines and is threatening legally binding rules if they don't. His officials even gave guidance to sunbathers on how much sunscreen they need to protect themselves. Apparently, it's the equivalent of about 6 teaspoons for the entire body. At a press briefing, one Spanish journalist scoffed, asking whether the EU would now be regulating all aspects of European holidays. But he may have been missing the point. The merits of sunscreens aside, one message came over loud and clear. The EU wants to be seen as the champion of the consumer. In short, it wants to be more relevant to ordinary people's lives and to be more popular with its citizens. This isn't the first time the European Commission has taken on big business to try and win brownie points with the voters. In the past few months, it's demanded that credit and debit card firms cut fees it described as outrageous. It's also attacked the charges for mobile phone calls made from abroad. The Commission is trying to listen to the voters, and its most important tool is Eurobarometer, a regular opinion poll conducted across the EU. The latest report, entitled The Future of Europe, and released this week, makes pretty grim reading for officials, with support for EU membership slumping to below 50%. But it did contain some positive signs. In particular, voters want the EU to do more in the fight against terrorism and organised crime, in health and on the international scene. It also found that Europe's single market in goods and services is popular with voters. When the European Commission published its long-awaited paper on the future of Europe, also this week, it reflected many of the very same themes. The document challenged national leaders to sign a new declaration of their European commitment. It notably stressed the benefits of Europe's single market to consumers, and it called for cooperation on health threats and on food security. But most important of all, it asked for more European integration in the fight against terrorism and organised crime, calling on governments to surrender their national vetoes in policy making here. Significantly, this is something they can do under existing rules, if all heads of government agree. The European Commission President, José Manuel Barroso, piled pressure on them to do so, asking if Europe had to wait for another terrorist outrage before beefing up its cooperation on security. After no votes in referendums in France and the Netherlands last year, the EU constitution is on ice, with little prospect of agreement before France's presidential elections in 2007. But the Barroso plan at least gives the EU a path forward for the next 12 months. And, if Eurobarometer is to be believed, more EU measures in the single market and against terrorism and organised crime will be popular, even in Eurosceptical nations. Of course, only time will tell whether the EU's new sensitivity to public opinion will help it win over those grumpy European voters. One rival theory doing the rounds in Brussels is that citizens will only begin to give the EU the benefit of the doubt when they feel it's beginning to make them wealthier. And here there was some modestly good news as well. A spring economic report predicted growth in the EU of 2.3% this year, much faster than the 1.6% achieved last year. In short, there are a few rays of sunshine, both for Europe and its economy, though perhaps no need to reach for the sun lotion just yet. This is Stephen Castle in Brussels.
Growing numbers of Poles are opening business and taking up jobs in neighbouring countries, such as the Czech Republic, Slovakia and Hungary. Initially, most of the Polish job seekers went to the UK, Ireland and Sweden, which were the first to open up their labour markets. But increasingly, Poles are discovering that they can easily fill niches in labour markets closer to home. Radio Polonia's Iwona Lehmann reports.
It seems that for some Poles, the Czech Republic, Slovakia and Hungary may be just as attractive to earn money and live in as the UK and Sweden. According to the Polish Ministry of Economy, the number of Poles taking up jobs in the Czech Republic increased by around 40% in the past year or so, by over 70% in Hungary and even as much as 80% in Slovakia. Poland's high unemployment, now standing at 18%, is one of the reasons for Polish job seekers to look south. On the other hand, in Germany, which closed its labour market for new EU members, the number of jobs taken up by Poles increased by just 20%. Marcin Kulinicz of the Ministry of Economy in Warsaw explains there is a certain profile of jobs in which Poles get employment across the southern border.
Well, that can be definitely one of reasons. If I look at the professional structure of those who undertook employment in the Czech Republic, way over half of them, approximately 60%, work in the industry. And if we add to that approximately 25% who work in mining, we can see that employment of Poles in the Czech Republic is focused on industry. So these are just industry workers who were recruited by Czech companies to work there. Because despite the lack of huge cultural differences, it's anyway quite difficult to go to the other country and work there, especially in other sectors where you need at least the language knowledge.
Anticor, a company from southern Poland producing anti-corrosion materials, is a firm which conquered 80% of the Czech market and opened its branches not only in Prague but also in Bratislava, Slovakia. At a time when the Polish market is already overflowing with businesses and services, according to analysts, there are still plenty of opportunities in the Czech Republic and Slovakia. Marek Janka of Anticor says the two countries are a perfect place for doing business.
From our experience, Slovak market is very similar to Poland. Maybe the Slovak administration is more friendly for new foreign investors. The Czech market is a little bit different. I can say the labor is more effective than in Poland or Slovakia. Administration in the Czech Republic is similar like in Slovakia. That means friendly to investors, and the clients in Czech Republic are a little bit more conservative, like in Poland. It means it's hard to start with them, but the business after is more stable.
Apart from low unemployment in the Czech Republic and Slovakia, the proximity of Polish, Czech and Slovak, which are mutually intelligible, there is one more reason why more and more Poles are heading south in search of jobs and business opportunities. Polish businessmen are becoming aware of the fact that Slovakia and to some extent the Czech Republic have liberalized their economies to make them more attractive for foreign investment and for foreigners seeking jobs. Jiří Branka of the trade office in Prague lists the reasons why he expects the number of Poles in the Czech Republic to go on growing.
Polish language is not so close as Slovak, but it is the second closest language to the Czech one. So this is one reason. But second reason, well, prices or fees or salaries should be the second reason. I think that still it is a little bit higher here in the Czech Republic, so probably people can get better money here. And the last reason is that it should be very close. Interesting should be comparison of, let's say, unemployment in border regions in the Czech Republic and in Poland. So maybe there is some problem with higher unemployment rate in border regions of Poland, so people can get easier work in the Czech border regions.
So as the Czech, Slovaks and Hungarians welcome the incoming Polish workers and businesses with open arms, there are those who wonder how long it will take Germany and Austria to follow suit.
And thanks to Radio Polonia's Iwona Lehmann. For our last report today on Network Europe, we are heading to France, where Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin is plummeting in French opinion polls. After the failure to address youth unemployment, he's been involved in a corruption scandal and accused of secretly investigating numerous politician, industrialist and senior public servants. Now, however, he's come up with a very creative way to boost national morale and put himself back on the cutting edge, especially with disenchanted young voters. His pet project, a huge contemporary art show celebrating French achievement, opened this week. But it hasn't completely silenced his critics. RFI's Catherine Galloway reports.
Right now, France is sending out just one message.
Every day, in every way, I'm getting better and better. Every day, in every way, I'm getting better and better. Every day, in every way, I'm getting better and better. Every day, in every way.
This sound installation is part of a massive show dedicated to contemporary art that opened this Wednesday at the Grand Palais in Paris, in a blaze of publicity and, predictably, controversy. La Force de l'Art was the brainchild of Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin back in October. He wanted to show that French creativity was able to compete with the best on offer abroad. Now that's a tough challenge when modern art-loving billionaire François Pinault has just taken his collection to Venice after French administration thwarted his plans for a museum in Paris. And two of the show's original 15 curators backed out, saying 6 months wasn't long enough to organise such an ambitious event. Finally, several artists boycotted what they saw as Villepin's exhibition, stating that art should not be used to reflect glory on an ailing government, and fearing that the selection would be too nationalistic. But despite all this, the doors did open on time, and art critic Eleanor Hartney has come especially from New York to see the show. I asked her if she'd detected worrying signs of political meddling or of Villepin's own taste in the works selected.
Not in the show itself, I don't think. No, I know there's been a lot of talk about how it was thrown together very quickly and that it has a certain agenda about promoting French art. But given the constraints, it was done very intelligently. It's not so nationalistic. I think, you know, maybe it was born of politics, but the actual effect here is really much more about talking about French art as a part of and not separate from this larger international context. I mean, I'm discovering a lot of very interesting work that I was not familiar with, so that's a very good thing.
Now that's music to the ears of Bernard Blisten, the head of visual art at the Ministry of Culture, who coordinated La Force de l'Art. He also denies the nationalism charge.
This is not a froggy show. This show is fresh, open. The goal was really to put together a lot of artists to bring that energy and to give to a quite large public the possibility to judge the works. And to me, this is definitely the challenge. And I do prefer to talk about art in front of art.
Lola, a performance artist and fashion designer, was one of the first visitors to puzzle over the videos, sculpture and painting on offer. I asked her if she thought contemporary art was thriving in France.
Oh, definitely. Thanks God, you know. We almost had a fantastic exhibition here from François Pinault that went to Venice, so I'm really proud that finally we also have something here.
Do you think Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin was right to become so involved in this project, or do you think
art and politics should be separate.
Oh, no, I think he's definitely right. Thanks God he did something good, at least.
Someone else who doesn't mind the mix of art and politics is Frederik Rambinesing. He's one of 50 guides to the show, all of whom are artists struggling on the minimum wage or the long-term unemployed from poor backgrounds. That's thanks to an initiative supported by the Ministry of Culture. I asked him what his job involved.
First of all, it would be to look after the security things, look after the art, and maybe learn something about it. We will have, you know, these stickers with a lot of phrases from contemporary art, and we will have to give it to the people and maybe think about it, talk about it. So maybe if they ask me a question, I will ask them a question too. All the people critics these things, but they want to know. We have a big job on this exhibition.
How do you think this exhibition might help the image of Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin?
He will enjoy it because they will say art contemporary is for the young people, so he will have maybe a part of the youngs who come back to him. You will have those who will say he's doing that for his image and he's not doing anything. And for myself, I will say thank you anyway because I have a job.
So despite the criticism and his current slump in the opinion polls, the Prime Minister might have succeeded in creating some positive echoes in the French art world, at least.
And that wraps up Network Europe this week. The programme is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Radio Polonia, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Slovak Radio, Radio Prague, Radio Slovenia International, Radio Ukraine and Deutsche Welle. I'll leave you with the German country band Texas Lightning and No, No, Never, the German entry to next week's Eurovision Song Contest. And not that I'm biased, but make sure to vote next Saturday. On behalf of our pan-European team, I'm Barbara Gruber. Thanks for tuning in.
Believe me, I got more than enough. Keep trying.